listener production. Hi, Sasha Barber-Gatt with you. Welcome to The Briefing. A major escalation in the long-running conflict between Israel and Iran happened over the weekend. Iran launching a massive retaliatory strike on Israel after an Israeli airstrike hit Iran's consulate in Syria last week. At worst, this could be the beginning of an all-out war in the Middle East.
It's particularly significant because it's the first time the Iranians have actually attacked Israel directly.
In this episode of The Briefing, we speak with Professor Michael Humphrey from the University of Sydney to explain. But first, here are the headlines with Antoinette Latouf. It is Wednesday, April 17.
G'day, Sasha. Hello, everyone. We begin in Sydney today with an update out of the Bondi Junction stabbing attack. The nine-month-old baby who was senselessly stabbed during Saturday afternoon's rampage has now been moved out of intensive care. The girl's mum, Ashley Good, acted quickly when her daughter was attacked, handing her to two strangers to look after her. Tragically, Ashley had also been stabbed and died later in hospital from her wounds. The Westfield Shopping Centre remains closed, but yesterday Ashley's family visited the scene of the tragedy, laying flowers and collecting teddy bears that had been left by mourners for the baby.
There has also been some developments on the stabbing of two religious officials at a church in Sydney's southwest. More details about the alleged attacker, a 16-year-old boy, have come to light, including that he had previously been suspended from school for carrying a knife and was also on a good behaviour bond over a weapons charge. The incident, which was live streamed to thousands of people, has been declared a terrorist act. The boy is yet to be charged, while the men who were injured are both stable. Antoinette, watching what has been happening outside that church over the last couple of days, I know the first night as many as 2,000 people rocked up and were demanding revenge. Police were injured, ambos were injured. It was really awful. Last night, police were there keeping people away from the scene. The church did ask people to stay away, but some wanted to come and pay their respects and, I suppose, pray and mourn what had happened. You just can't deny, though, that tensions are really high in the community at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And I understand that people are still incredibly upset about the Bondi attack and probably responded, actually, that's an understatement, did respond disproportionately. The 16-year-old had been pinned down. They did a citizen's arrest, which I think was absolutely appropriate, so he couldn't do any more harm. But once authorities are there, people need to clear out and let authorities do their job. Mob justice isn't what I believe any faith preaches. And so while people might be defensive and really love their priests and their religious leaders, they just need to back off and let the authorities do what they're there to do. I do also wonder, this being declared a terrorist act so quickly, what that would do to community relationships. I know that Dai Lee, who's the independent MP that who's in charge of that area, has come out and said, I really hope the Premier and authorities have a good reason for this, because there is so much friction amongst different religious communities. That is a very multicultural region in southwest Sydney. It's so hard to know what is declared a terrorist act, what is a mental instability, what is a lone wolf attacker, what is someone who, as we heard with the Bondi attacker, was had a history of mental illness and didn't like that he didn't have a girlfriend. Like, what constitutes what? How do we apply these labels? And what additional damage and fear does that add to the community?
Yeah, it's undoubtable that as soon as that terrorist word was uttered, it did feel like a potential ramp up of the tensions that already existed, that were already there. So, yeah, it's an interesting question, Antoinette, one I don't have the answer to. A blow to Julian Assange's bid to avoid extradition to the US, now that the US government's lawyers have given a bunch of assurances about his fate if he does make it onto their soil. Let's take you back. The WikiLeaks founder had been challenging the extradition order in England's High Court and was thrown a lifeline last month when the two presiding judges ordered the US to provide assurances that Assange would not face the death penalty, he could defend his actions under the First Amendment right to free speech, and Assange would not be prejudiced at trial because of his Australian nationality.
So at first that might sound like a good thing, but the key point is that if he didn't get these assurances, the judge might have approved the appeal for him not to be extradited to the US. But now that the US has provided those assurances, it means lawyers for both sides will return to court on May 20 to make final representation before the justices to decide. Assange is facing multiple charges in America relating to the publication of classified information on the WikiLeaks website that he founded. Linda Reynolds, the former Home Affairs Minister and also the former boss of Brittany Higgins and Bruce Lerman, has spoken out following Lerman's defamation defeat. Reynolds is vowing to proceed with her own defamation case against Brittany Higgins and Higgins' partner David Shiraz. She's declared that accusations of a political cover-up have been dispelled in the Lerman case. It's after the judge in the Lerman defamation verdict said Higgins and Shiraz had pushed a narrative of a political cover-up to journalists from the first moment, which he found no evidence for.
Yeah, and Reynolds has said she's faced years of criticism over her handling of Higgins' rape allegation, saying, quote, "For 3 years I've endured intense public scrutiny, vilification, vile trolling, and have been demonised as the villain in a story of a political cover-up I have always known to be untrue," end quote. The rape allegation was proven true on the balance of probabilities in court on Monday. She also said both her and her former chief of staff, Fiona Brown, had lost their careers, had their reputations destroyed, and also their health seriously and irreparably compromised. So this six-week trial, Antoinette, is due to begin on July 24th. So it's not over. This political back and forth that inevitably this case has become will continue in July. Whether Brittany Higgins and David Shiraz return from France to attend, whether they have to, remains to be seen.
I did think in the very long judgment in Lerman's defamation case, which was incredibly damning on Lerman, when it was made clear that the political cover-up didn't have as much legs, or at the very least that Lisa Wilkinson and Network 10 should have investigated it or scrutinised it more closely, something did kind of ping in my brain going, "Oh, this bodes well for Linda Reynolds and her claims."
Yeah, we've heard from opposition leader Peter Dutton as well. He says Reynolds has been vindicated by this federal court decision from Justice Michael Lee.
I think that's a stretch. I think that's probably, you know, given a little more legitimacy to her claims. It is important also to point out that in March 2021, Reynolds agreed to pay damages to Higgins as part of a defamation settlement over calling Higgins a lying cow.
Yeah, you're right. But it is also worth pointing out that Reynolds says she didn't make the comment in relation to Higgins' rape allegations. It was in relation to the news reports about how Reynolds had handled it that she was making that comment. Either way, it's a pretty sorry saga. I don't think anyone comes out of it looking very good. And look, we can't finish up today without talking about the wild supermarket Senate inquiry yesterday, during which the Woolies CEO was threatened with jail time.
Subject to a penalty of up to 6 months imprisonment or a fine of not exceeding $5,000.
So that was Green Senator Nick McKim, who went toe-to-toe with Brad Banducci of Woolworths and Linda Weckert of Coles. Both Banducci and Weckert copped a grilling about their profits, their own pay, and how they deal with suppliers during the two-hour standoff with some very visibly angry senators, Antoinette.
Yeah, so one line of questioning was around the company's return on equity, and that's a financial ratio used to evaluate the profitability and efficiency of a company. While Weckert could answer that it's 31% for Coles, the Woolworths boss couldn't and repeatedly dodged the question.
I've answered the question many times.
You have not answered the question, Mr. Banducci. Honestly, I'm not interested in your spin or your bullshit.
Wow.
Banducci was threatened with jail time for not answering the question, and he never actually gave an answer, saying he just doesn't know.
I was loving all of these videos coming through. It's nice to see such rich people who are being accused of, you know, not in a court of criminal law or anything like that, but in terms of like what Woolies and Coles have been doing during the cost of living crisis when people are doing it really tough, it's nice to see them being held accountable and directly asked about these issues. One thing that stood out to me was this staff discount code issue. So the Coles boss was asked if she uses a staff discount when she does her own grocery shopping at Coles. Now, she makes $3.3 million a year. She admitted that she does use it. Now, we don't know what that percentage off is. My guess would be it could be It could be relatively low, but it could maybe be 50%. Who knows? Maybe we'll never find out. But Banducci said he didn't.
Yeah, but he owns $8.4 million.
$3.3 is still enough to not need to use a discount.
No, I know, but he earns like more than double what she earns. So firstly, I'd be like, why is the Woolies boss earning so much more than me? But also, I mean, the fact that either of them would ever need to use a... You know what? If it was offered to you, though, would you still not use it? No matter what you earned?
Look, they say that that's how the rich stay rich, is that they use what they can. They are cheap in certain areas of their life so that they can keep that money. I mean, I don't know. I just coming out like this, it's not a good look. You can't deny that it's not a good look.
But I also can't deny that if it was offered to me on that salary that I would also use it. I don't know.
Okay. Thank you, Antoinette. Let's get into today's deep dive, looking at what's going on between Iran and Israel. Over the weekend, we saw a dramatic escalation of a long-running shadow war that's being waged between Israel and Iran. After an airstrike on Iran's consulate in Syria last week, Tehran responded with a barrage of 300 missiles and drones aimed at Israeli territory. Most were intercepted, as many as 99% according to Israel, but it is being deemed a watershed moment in the conflict. Today we're going to take you through why this is such a big development and whether we can soon expect all-out war in the Middle East. Joining me now to explain is Professor Michael Humphrey from the University of Sydney. Professor, thanks for your time. Can you tell us why this strike by Iran against Israel is so significant?
It's particularly significant because it's the first time the Iranians have actually attacked Israel directly. There's been a shadow war going on for decades, but particularly in the last 10 years, between Israel and Iran.
Why does the conflict exist? What have they been fighting about, for want of a better word?
I mean, within the Middle East, there's a division over a kind of the leadership of Iran and the Shia kind of revolutionary movement and the more, you might say, conservative Arab states. But in other words, there's a religious cleavage, there's a geopolitical divide, and the Iranians have projected their influence into numerous states, particularly those that have been in conflict, including Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, and Yemen, in which there's been conflict in all of those countries. And they've had a big impact on Arab states' thinking and, in fact, direct conflicts such as in Yemen. You know, the Saudis and the UAE have been fighting forces, the Houthi, who the Iranians have allegedly backed.
We know that this was in response to the strike on the Iranian consulate in Syria, which killed 13 people. Do we know anything else about what Iran was hoping to achieve with this airstrike?
The demolition of the consulate, the Iranian consulate in Damascus, killed senior Revolutionary Guard leaders. And so it was a big impact on their operations and their projection of influence in the area and military kind of activity. What the Israelis were doing was essentially, I mean, the way it's described as upping the kind of deterrence factor. In other words, we're going to show you that you can't mess around with us. The Iranian response, I think, is much more a question of they couldn't let this go without them doing something. And in recent months, there was another incident where the Iranians' militia in Iraq attacked an American base. That was an indirect attack, in other words, in US and Israeli interests. So this time was a kind of taken as a confrontation, and apparently in Iran, there was a big division between the kind of extreme wing and the leadership of Khomeini and others who wanted a less kind of aggressive stance.
I am curious to know, I mean, at the time of recording this, we know Israel's war cabinet met a few hours ago. They talked about that they had maybe delayed their offensive, their ground offensive in Rafah in Gaza, in order to kind of consider what to do with Iran. They have said that they will, quote, exact a price, what that price is and what they want to do. We don't know at this stage. Is Israel capable of kind of fighting this war on two fronts, if we've got Gaza on one side and Iran on the other, how does that look for Israel? How does that play out?
Look, I mean, I think everybody has to remember that the Gaza conflict is directly related to Iranian influence and interests in the region. So the Israelis have looked at Gaza as a kind of a sharp point for attacking Iranian influence and pushing it back. You know? So the idea that there are different wars, it's the same war. And sure, the question of the impact of the Israeli or the IDF operations in Gaza have been extremely damaging in terms of destruction of kind of their habitat, environment, as well as civilian population. But it is a kind of, in many ways, a proxy war with the Iranians and saying, you cannot do this, you know. And so that kind of context of the war is not an either or. It's like ultimately the Israelis are really interested in pushing the Iranians back from their borders in terms of the capacity they have to challenge them. I don't mean threaten them. I mean, I don't think this is an existential question, but it is a major military one. And the recent confrontation has interestingly changed the public perception, or at least internationally, of the Israelis, because they've become the victims of an Iranian attack, whereas previously they were the persecutors of the civilian population in Gaza and, you know, denying humanitarian aid access and limiting and restricting it, and even coming, you know, being brought before the ICJ, being accused of genocide. So at this moment, the dilemma for Israel is that suddenly they're now being in the good books. If they go further and they attack Iran, and I'm not sure what they would do at all. Maybe it's going to be primarily strategic, focused on military targets and things, but it's just a risk escalation. And the whole region is very worried about it because, of course, you know, the Straits of Hormuz and the oil around the Gulf is extremely vulnerable to kind of an attack, an escalation of conflict. And Arab states, such as the UAE and Saudi Arabia, would also worry about an escalation and what it would have, the impact it would have on their countries.
What has the response been from world leaders given the fears of an escalation?
I think it's been consistent for quite a few months. In fact, from the very start, the very start of the Gaza conflict was the fear of escalation. Everybody recognised it at the very beginning, and there's been a lot of diplomatic effort. And even the Australian government identifying this kind of position of we must recognise a Palestinian state. The Palestinian state is the key issue for the Iranians, you know, protect the Palestinians. So, as historically, the question of Palestine was at the forefront of Arab nationalism and Arab nationalist states in their kind of conflict with Israel. Iran took this up. So if they could remove the question of Palestine from the equation, in other words, establish a peace process which will really happen, then that would diffuse Iranian kind of militancy and ability to mobilize people in the area, groups such as, you know, Hezbollah and Hamas and others.
What can we expect to see from the US? Obviously, one of Israel's, if not Israel's strongest ally. Could the US be dragged into this and then in turn Australia because we're an ally of America?
I think it's much more a question about America than us, but the US is in a kind of difficult position. You know, they took a hard line against Netanyahu on the question of humanitarian aid and the attack on Rafah. At the same time, as soon as the Iranians threatened retaliation for the consulate strike, which the Americans were very annoyed about, not the Israelis haven't admitted it, but the Americans were really annoyed about it. They didn't know about it. But when they were attacked, the US, Jordan, perhaps Saudi Arabia, it's quite a few countries, not all of them have declared their hand, assisted in defending the Israelis, you know, and their drone attack, right? But the US has already said, we're not going to support any further attack on Iran. But if they did attack and the Iranians retaliated, what are the Americans going to do? I think they'll be forced to continue their position of defending Israel.
Give us a timeline. What can we expect, or what do you expect to see happen over the next few weeks and months in this space?
Look, it's very, very hard to know. You'd really hope that the Israelis are constrained by the diplomatic efforts to not escalate it, you know, because the consequences are just kind of, in a sense, unknowable but destructive to some degree. I mean, Gaza is, you know, immediately gets eclipsed, but I mean, that's got to be brought to an end. But what that means, I don't know. The Israelis, in a sense, have become a de facto occupying power with responsibilities, you know, because that their military is in control of the territory. But they don't want to do that. But then again, you know, they are kind of undermining any authority or capacity of UNRWA. They always wanted to kind of stigmatize UNRWA and get it away because they see that UNRWA is perpetuating the identity of the refugee. Even its alliance with NGOs, the World Central Kitchen, they've kind of messed that up. So there's the sense of who are they going to get to come in and be administrators and providers of welfare and humanitarian aid and rebuild. You know, the Arab states are not going to be interested in doing that unless there's a real commitment to changing the political equation in relation to the Palestinians. In other words, a real commitment to a Palestinian two-state solution. For quite some time, people have said the two-state solution is dead. Well, I mean, look at the problem of the, 700,000 settlers in the West Bank now. I mean, that's incredibly complicated. I mean, what's going to happen? You know, where are they going to go? Who's going to tell them to go, and who's going to force them to go? You know.
Well, as always, I find with these discussions, you've answered a lot of questions, but inevitably, so many more are raised. Professor Michael Humphrey, thank you so much for your time and for joining us today.
Okay, well, thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you for listening to today's briefing. That is all for this morning. Before you go, though, I have to ask you a favour. If you enjoyed this ep or got something out of it, we'd really appreciate if you could share it with someone who you think might also enjoy it. And if you want to keep up with our other content on socials, you can check us out on Instagram at The Briefing Podcast. We upload full weekend briefing chats on YouTube as well as our Sex Work series episodes. And we're also on TikTok. For YouTube and TikTok, search Listener Newsroom. That's LISTNR. I'm Sasha Barbagat. See you next time. Listener.